Welcome to Feminists Without Mystique, a podcast where we process politics, sex, and the unrelenting fire hose of bullshit in the news through an unapologetically feminist lens. Each week, we vent about the news, go deep on one important issue, call out terrible things happening below the top headlines in a segment called We See You, and then we'll end with something hopeful. And today, I am solo because my co-host is sadly sick, day two of a nasty cold virus vomity thing. I don't know. It sounds bad. So she is resting as she should. So I am here today. I first just wanted to thank a fan on Ko-fi, the website where you can buy us, or I guess it is pronounced coffee, but it's the place where you can buy us a coffee or contribute to the work that we do if you like it. So thank you so much, Sandra Fowler. I hope I'm saying your name right. Fowler. She says, big fan of the baddest bitches in podcasting. Wish you had a Patreon. Keep it up. Burn the patriarchy to the ground. Bathe in the ashes. I love it. We will. We're going to continue to do that. Thank you so much for the support. It means so much. It's really greatly appreciated. Anyone that contributes, it goes towards hardware and software costs pretty much. And like licensing, like the intro and outro music that you hear, that's just like, you know, the happy like springboard of our episode. Actually costs money because all of the free ones we didn't really like. They just didn't really capture our vibe. Anyway, so that costs like, I think like $100 a year. I kind of forgot that it was on my credit card. And then like when I was checking a statement a couple of months ago, I was like, oh fuck, it's like an annual, you just get slapped with like an annual charge. So anyway, I put a note on my calendar for next year. But yeah, so these, they're like, you know, a lot of little costs, but then they add up to a little chunk of change. So anyway, thank you so much for buying us a coffee and for the support, Sandra. We really, really appreciate it. We also were featured, we were guests on the podcast Some Kind of Brown. We had a conversation about whiteness and how to be a good white ally. In her promo, the podcast Some Kind of Brown said, what do we do when whiteness seems like a hurdle in front of us? What's it like to be a white ally? Maria and Aaron from Feminists Without Mystique join us to talk about the politics and whiteness. Anyway, so go check it out. It's the podcast Some Kind of Brown, and it's episode 60, The Politics of Whiteness in America. It was a really, really great conversation, and we had so much fun talking about it and listening. and I hope to do another podcast like that with Natalie soon. And as always, if you're liking us, rate and review, subscribe, do all that good stuff. And if we're not on a platform that you want to hear us on, let us know. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcast, Castbox, TuneIn, Overcast, Podchaser, lots of different forums. Today, I'm probably just going to do kind of a brief musings on some of the news of the last week, and then go a little bit deep on just kind of a more philosophical question of kind of what we do when we feel as dark as I think a lot of us feel in these trying times for a variety of reasons, different things, different days. And then I'll do some We See You's and end with a good thing. So just jumping in, it has been super frustrating today. Today I'm recording on Wednesday. And this is after Trump's announcement that Mike Pence is going to lead the fight against the coronavirus. Not thrilled about that. It's Mike Pence is probably one of the worst people. It didn't even occur to me that he would be put in charge of this. I mean, I knew it would be something, you know, I I didn't think that Trump would have a reasonable or intelligent response per se, but putting Mike Pence in charge was definitely extra jarring and unsettling, and definitely didn't inspire faith, at least for me personally. But then it looked like that was reflected in the Dow and the stock market, which seemed to plummet while he was talking. That's according to Twitter, though. I haven't like fully fact checked that, but it was news. People were reporting, it seems like, at least initially, just as he started to talk, people, like, you know, international markets were like, oh, fuck. But Mike Pence, specifically on public health, has such a bad record. It's been criticized widely because he doesn't really believe in science. He actually has said in the past that, you know, smoking is really not bad for you. I mean, the quote is, he said, quote, "Despite the hysteria from the political class and media, smoking doesn't kill. In fact, 2 out of every 3 smokers does not die from a smoking related illness, and 9 out of 10 smokers do not contract lung cancer." So, I mean, he said this in 2000, but it's still, I mean, in 2000, it was pretty clear. I mean, I was certainly seeing in health class all the anti-smoking ads, and so yeah, that was a thing, and science was totally on top of that in 2000. Pence is someone who advocates teaching creationism in public schools. He's not a fan of a meaningful separation of church and state. He was, you know, you'll remember the governor of Indiana, where the infamous Supreme Court case about baking a cake for a gay couple was controversial. And then, crucially, Pence was also oversaw one of the biggest HIV outbreaks in his state, because he was slow on approving needle exchanges and was just generally, like, he obviously doesn't, it's pretty clear that he doesn't value the lives of the LGBTQ community that much. I mean, at one point Trump said, "Oh, this guy would hang them if he could," which was like, wow, okay. Pretty jarring. And he also, I think he is a proponent of conversion therapy. I'm pretty sure I've read that. I just don't have that right in front of me, but pretty sure he thinks that that's something that works, even though the data suggests that it actually contributes to more suicides among the LGBTQ community. So yeah, this is definitely not inspiring any faith. And this is coming at a time when panic about the coronavirus is sort of hitting a peak that it hasn't before. I certainly, yesterday I put hand sanitizer in my Amazon cart, because I read the New York Times article like everyone else, and then got distracted doing other things. And by the time I came back to it in the afternoon, that hand sanitizer was totally gone. So that was unsettling. And it's like little small things like that, that, I think caused me to panic. When I think about how other people are panicking, it causes me to panic. And I think, obviously, I'm sure there's like a lot of psychology around, like, you know, mass panic and the way that people behave when they're scared and when they feel like their health and safety are being threatened, and when there seems like there's about to be a resource scarcity. So I think that we're living in a pretty scary time. If it's true that it's not a question of if, but when the coronavirus actually hits the United States, and it's going to be something that we're all going to have to really be mindful of, and it might actually significantly disrupt our lives. I think, you know, I would like to think that we have experts actually running the department and running this strategy to help combat this virus, and to make sure that we're prepared. Mike Pence seems just completely confusing. I don't know why, you know, he doesn't seem to be very interested in public health at all. So yeah, it's pretty jarring. Let's see. I feel like there was another point I wanted to make around the coronavirus and Trump and Pence's, you know, non-participation in this. But I might, it might just have like fully slipped out of my mind. So while I'm trying to search for that point, there was another debate last night in South Carolina, which was a complete and total shit show. It was, I mean, I watched the first 30 to 45 minutes, and I have to say, I couldn't bring myself to watch much more of it. It was really disturbing. It turns out that the South Carolina Democratic Party, so there was a moment where, or there were a few moments, and I felt like I was kind of being like a paranoid, jaded jerk, but I felt like, okay, Bloomberg had to have been paying people in this audience, because there's no way that this many human people are actually huge, passionate fans of Bloomberg in a way that they would loudly boo Warren and Sanders. Like, there was just like, there were these people that were like booing them, and it just didn't make any sense to me. And it turns out that, like, yeah, I mean, it costs like over $1,500 to get into some of these, to get into the Democratic debate. Tickets cost between $1,700 and $3,200. So, because, yeah, the Charleston County Democratic Party, their website, said that the only guaranteed way to get a ticket is to become a sponsor of the debate. That's nuts to me. I mean, I had never really thought about debate audiences past the fact that, like, I think they seem kind of stupid to me. I think kind of like some of the presidential debates and like the VP debate, I don't think that this is not a sporting event. And I don't really care what, like, I don't want an audience reaction to influence what I think of what a candidate says. And it always does. And most of the time I'm at odds with the audience reaction. And then that feels really alienating and frustrating. And it's like, why do I care what the, you know, but audience reactions also impact the debate itself. So, it's distracting to the candidates, or it jazzes them up, or it discourages them. It's just like, it's a totally unnecessary, element to have an effective debate. So that was frustrating. But yeah, so it does actually turn out, that people in the debate audience, no wonder they were so friendly to Bloomberg, and, you know, they were pretty tolerant of Steyer, who, like, really at this point, so confusing to me why he's there, was because these people paid a fuck ton of money. So they're much more comfortable with moderate positions and people who aren't advocating for wealth taxes. So that makes sense, and is extremely unhelpful. It's just like not what we need in this moment. So, I mean, we definitely didn't even need a debate. I would have been really happy if the Nevada debate was the last one, but whatever. We're rolling along. The Nevada Democratic primary, Bernie won. Yay, Bernie. Whatever. Saturday, actually, Aaron and I were lucky enough to get to see Warren while she was here in Seattle. We stood in line for 3 hours and, you know, got to hear her speak. And that was really great. And this point has been made on Twitter a lot. But Warren, you know, when she got up there, she said, congratulations to Bernie. He won the Nevada primary. And the crowd cheered, generally, you know, there weren't any like loud boos. It wasn't, you know, it was just kind of like a bunch of mature, supportive, adult, liberal people who, you know, our preference is Warren, but, you know, if Sanders gets the nomination, we'll be fine with it and campaign for him. So, you know, I guess I feel like that is emblematic of her followers. Whereas, you know, that if Warren had won and Bernie had said like, congrats to Elizabeth, she won, which, by the way, like, he wouldn't, or at least from what I've seen, I cannot fathom him having that type of like a gracious, friendly response, you know that his audience would be vicious, I think, is probably the best word. That's Saturday. But the South Carolina primary is coming up this Saturday, and then Super Tuesday will be upon us. I think next week, 2 weeks from now, it's coming up. And if Bernie wins the majority of delegates there, it's going to be really hard for anyone else to take him on. So, I mean, in some ways that's good. It's like, just rip the Band-Aid. Like, if it's going to be Bernie, it's going to be Bernie. I mean, I'm happy that it is Bernie over Bloomberg. But I also feel like his supporters, I'm not super happy with giving his supporters that win, that W. And my goodness, if Bernie does not beat Trump, I want all of those Bernie supporters to eat so much crow. But I don't, you know, again, I want Bernie to beat Trump, but it's just like, okay, if we give you this opportunity, you better beat him. You better beat him. anyway, so that's kind of that. The debate overall was an absolute mess, and people were yelling over each other, and it was just like a cacophony. It was not anything that the American people really actually needed to see. There were no real meaningful distinctions that I thought were drawn up. I mean, everyone went after Bernie specifically. There were still more jabs at Bloomberg, which are like so easy. He definitely did not recover in any way. Like, he had a really bad performance in Nevada, and he had a really bad performance last night. He just is not, he obviously isn't used to like debating anyone or being challenged in any real way, because he's an extremely powerful billionaire. And to that end, he had Bloomberg 2020 signs that were up in Flint, Michigan, and someone papered over one of them, "Eat the Rich." And then his team retweeted, "Eat the Rich. Like, that's the type of society we live in. We're America's better than this." And it's really striking to me that their team would be this clueless. And I think it speaks to why they're not even creating like a facade that they really care about people or understand the working class or really understand the critique against his very candidacy, which is that he's buying the fucking election. But also, like, Flint, Michigan, which still doesn't have clean water and hasn't had clean water for, I think at this point, 2 years, maybe 3 years. The fact that, you know, people are saying "eat the rich," which is like so innocuous, you know, and it's and America deserves better. No, you know, yes, America deserves better than you. You know, we deserve a better option than another New York billionaire who actually could have used a small fragment of the funds that he's used in the last 2 months to selfishly fund his own campaign in the Democratic primary, of which he has just registered last year as a Democrat. If he used even a teensy bit of his money, he could have fixed the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. And then he would be everyone's hero. Go fucking fix the water in Flint, Michigan. Put your money actually where your mouth is. You know, why don't you give a fuck ton of money to Stacey Abrams and her Fair Fight 2020? You know, make sure that we have like an infrastructure that will support voting equity across the country. Because we don't have that right now. And there are so many ways in which the system, the whole infrastructure of voting, is so feeble, and it is absolutely stacked against minorities. It's stacked against poor people, people who are in rural areas and don't have access to the proper information and are absolutely vulnerable to even the most basic disinformation campaigns, both online and through just having, I mean, the Koch brothers and other like wealthy conservative think tank groups and political action groups, like they have done this before, and we've written We See Yous about them, but you know, they will say, hey, you're actually supposed to go to this precinct when that's wrong, or that precinct is closed, or oh hey, you can't vote if you were ever a felon. And you know, while the law changes from state to state on that, it's like there are so many ways to dampen and discourage voters just through disinformation, and we need to really fight against that, and we need to make voting something that everyone can do up until the day of the election. Same day voters. I think Nevada had same day voter registration and had like something like 10,000 people voted or registered and voted on that day. I'm gonna have to go back and check that. I feel like I pulled that from somewhere, but yeah, I think there are small things, you know, there are small ways that Bloomberg could really use his money. We're a nation that responds, unfortunately, to the wealthy, the concerns and needs and interests of the wealthiest people. And he himself could run a giant lobbying corporation that actually could rival that of the NRA on gun rights, or it could rival the all these like faux Christian caring about, you know, abortion groups. It's just like he could throw Planned Parenthood $10 million and, you know, help shore up the, you know, the one Planned Parenthood in Kentucky. It's just, anyway, I'm just like rambling about what he could do with his money, which is a black hole. It is a spiral. And I think that, and anyway, that's another thing that sends people into this dark place so quickly, is like looking at Mike Bloomberg's like stupid face and his inability to even compete intellectually, really. I mean, I know that he's a smart businessman, but he is not good at debating. He certainly hasn't been able to effectively communicate why he is the best candidate, why we should listen to him, why he's better in any way. I mean, I don't understand how he's a better moderate than the moderates that we're looking at, Klobuchar and Buttigieg and Biden, I guess. I don't understand why he's a better billionaire than Steyer, who's, you know, he's at least qualified using, like, there have been polls that he has registered on. Some people like him. I don't understand who these people are, but there's a segment of people. So I don't understand how Bloomberg's a better billionaire than Steyer, why we should be listening to him. And I, you know, certainly I'm not persuaded that moderation is the way to go in this moment. So as someone who was already Warren 2020 all the way and then would vote for Bernie after on principle and on policy, I'm utterly unpersuaded by Bloomberg, and his presence in the race really is an insult to the democratic process. It really is. So, yeah, I mean, I forget what my initial point even was. Like, I think that I was talking about just the debate in general. The last point I guess that I would make on the debate is that the moderators, which I'm forgetting one of their names, but, and then Gil King, who's a delight, they just really, they did not have the debate under control. It was, you know, it's the moderator's role. I was so happy to see like two women moderating, but they really did not do a great job. I think they must have had some conversation where they thought like, we're going to let the candidates, we're going to step back and our role is going to be much more reserved here. But yeah, I just don't think that was necessarily the way to go in this situation. It just wasn't, because everyone was like, they were just sniping at each other and talking over each other. And if there's one thing that I think absolutely everyone on both sides of the aisle loathes, it's that type of like audio mess. You know, it makes everyone look bad. It makes everyone look petty and insecure and unprepared and immature. And it makes the moderators look bad, because it makes like they're not moderating. So that was bad. Harvey Weinstein was convicted of 2 out of the 5 accounts that he was accused of. He was convicted of rape and of a criminal sexual act. So that was good. He was acquitted on the more serious crime of rape in the first degree. And the jury was 7 men, 5 women. And hopefully he will serve an actual prison sentence. It was really gratifying that the jury listened to the women and actually decided to believe them. But also highly frustrating that the other charges were, he was acquitted. I think we'll probably have more to say on that. But I kind of want to wait and see what type of sentence he actually gets. And he's sentenced on March 11th. So that'll be important. But I also, I think, you know, and when we talk about it in more detail, we'll talk about how I think it's a really important precedent to set, that this is the type of, you know, this is a legal precedent. There's a certain amount of evidence that has to be considered overwhelming. You know, there were recordings the Manhattan DA sat on of Weinstein harassing a woman a few years ago. And there's story after story that were backed up contemporaneously. Hopefully there's a real legal precedent has been set here, despite the best efforts of Weinstein's horrendous female lawyer. I mean, and I'm saying female lawyer because she talked to the Daily, and a lot of kind of her persona seems to be this like highly feminized anti-Me Too warrior, kind of like she's the defender of a lot of different men who have been accused of sexual assault. And I don't know, it's really hard to understand exactly what she's doing there. Yes, everyone deserves their day in court and deserves a fair trial, but it's she seems like a slippery one. I'm not super, really, really dislike her. And she's now had a few opportunities, in interviews to make a persuasive case for why she's defending Weinstein and why she broadly defends men against sexual assault allegations. And, I think she represents probably like the most toxic internalized misogyny in public form right now. I don't know. That mantle could also go to Ivanka Trump, but I'm going to choose to give that crown to this lawyer. She's awful. So this next bit here, bear with me because it's definitely going to be a stream of consciousness mostly. But I've been in a bit of a reflective, nostalgic mood recently. Just kind of wondering like why I'm so sensitive and so down, you know, about politics and about the landscape of the world in the way that it is right now, and how that contrasts to, I think, what I thought the world was going to be and the progress that I thought we were going to be making together as a country. Certainly after the formative, when I was 18, the election of Obama, and even before that though, I mean, I had a really kind of lovely golden childhood and in of the 90s. There was just a way that I thought the world was moving, the direction that I thought the world was moving. I really, really don't, I don't necessarily think that it's going in the right direction now. And I know, you know, that evergreen MLK quote about the moral arc of justice is long, but it bends, or this arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. I recognize that. I hope that's true. I think there's like a bitterness to feeling like, you know, it's sort of selfish, kind of like a temper tantrum, but like, why do I have to live through this shit? You know, why do I have to be, you know, of childbearing age and like thinking about a family at some point in the next 10 years and looking at the next 10 years and thinking, based on what's happening, I don't know that I want to have a family, you know? I don't want to have a family of my own or children of my own, certainly not girls of my own. If we're just about to take away some of their rights, you know, some of their important rights. And if we're going to be not taking care of the environment and like bringing children into a world where the sea levels are rising and there are more forest fires and, you know, there are more viruses that are untended to because people like Trump are able to defund the entire pandemic force, which he did, by the way. I didn't even mention that when we were talking about coronavirus, but he, you know, there was someone who was already in place at the CDC because he had taken care of, you know, he was overseeing Ebola. And Trump decided that like that was the area that definitely needed to be defunded. Not essential. Well, okay, so here we are trying to play catch up. Yeah, I just find myself kind of adrift sometimes, and I think a lot of people do, and I think that contributes to a brittleness that makes like polite conversation about this really hard to have, or like patient conversation, because underneath every single conversation is this like volcanic rage for a lot of people. And it only takes like a small comment, like, well, maybe it'd be interesting because if Bloomberg won the primaries, wouldn't that be good? Because it would undermine the whole primary process and we'd have to reform them. And then cue a disproportionate like rage remark. Maybe that's too personal, but that was certainly a conversation that I had with my boyfriend and I have had. And it and it's like not fair because we should be able to have these like conversations without me like on such a hair trigger about it. It should be, I wish that I could separate the volcanic rage that is like a part of how I feel about all of this. It's just, I can't, it's inseparable. And I want to reform the Democratic primary process. And of course I want a Democrat to be president, but do I want it to be Bloomberg? And do I want the Democratic primary process to be reformed because we watch Bloomberg sail into office? I mean, this is looking less and less likely because he's had such bad debates. But you just never know. That guy has so much money. He can like really last. He could outlast everyone else just because he has the money, and then it'd be him versus Bernie. And if there's a contested like Democratic convention in the summer, I don't even know. Anyway, whew, it's scary. But kind of the point that I'm getting at is that when we feel the pile on and the pressure, and it's creeping in, and it ebbs away at least for me, it ebbs away at my patience. And I do laser in on smaller things and I find them intolerable and I want to cut the conversation off because it's like, well, don't you see how much I'm suffering already about all this huge landscape of injustice? How dare you want to have a conversation about Pete Buttigieg and his Medicare for those that want it? You know, there are just smaller, more innocuous conversations that could be interesting if I could separate myself a little bit intellectually from the volcano, but I can't. I will try. I mean, I think at this point, at least in my apartment, my boyfriend and I have sort of come to a an understanding that I, you know, sort of had to bring up, where I just said, like, we should not be fighting about this. And this is mostly on me, because I am the one who is, like, incapable at this point of having, like, a reasonable intellectual conversation that is, like, relatively light about this. So Bloomberg doesn't deserve to be in this space with us. Like, he doesn't deserve to take up so much air in our apartment. PT already takes up the air everywhere else. And Bernie and the frustrating Bernie bros, and whether or not there should be a wealth tax, and is that moral to tax people based on just their wealth that's in their bank, not on taxes, not tax them, you know, after their wealth on all their purchases. All these things, they're conversations that are, you know, worth having, but if we can't have them, we can't have them. If, like, in this moment in history, in this primary season where things are just extremely personal, you know, I think especially for women who are supporting Warren, and are, again, like the article that talked about supporting Warren is means having your heart broken again. I think for a lot of women, it's just, it's truly too much to bear. And I think that we have to just be okay with that. And I think we have to, like, I think for people who are supporting other candidates, let's all just be gentle with each other as much as we possibly can. Because we're all going to have to be in this together, no matter who the primary candidate is. And it does not do to dwell on all of their little minor differences and say all these, like, these really dramatic things about how we won't vote for the primary candidate if, you know, it's like, no, we will vote for the Democratic candidate, whoever it is. That's what we have to do. If you truly loathe Trump and you truly want him out of office, there can be no other answer here. You do not stay home. You do not write in a candidate. You do not vote for Trump. You vote for whoever the Democratic candidate is. You just do. You have to. If you claim to care about what you say you care about, that I believe very strongly. But I'm coming more and more to the conclusion, and I'm probably arriving very late to it, is that we really need to, I think for our own sanity and our own just enjoyment of our lives, try not to bicker over the smaller stuff, the minutia. And hopefully next time around we revamp this process. I don't know. There are so many structural issues with the Democratic primary. It's so frustrating that, you know, it seems like there's a plurality of people in among Democrats that actually really, really love Warren. And because we went with Iowa and New Hampshire first, it really sort of set the race up. There are lots of frustrating things that kind of come with that, but let's try not to get sucked into it as more than we already have. Let's try not to, yeah, take the bait, because pundits and trolls online and reporters, everyone wants to bait us. And I know that I'm probably an easy target at this point. So, I don't know. I think, it's just, it's hard to really quantify, I think, like, the pain. And I'm, you know, like, I can't even imagine if I was even more, I don't know, if there was even more at stake for me. I mean, I'm a white woman, so there's not as much, but, as like a thinking, feeling human being who cares about other people and my uterus, The pain of the last 3 years has been pretty enormous. Watching all the policies that Trump has tried to enact, watching the presidency, which I actually had a lot of respect for, and public debate, which I actually found really interesting, even like more conservative conversations, on issues of like strong centralized government, decentralized government, fiscal conservatism, or like issues related to judicial restraint and the Supreme Court and free speech, and like who decides if you should there be any mechanisms to restrict free speech, and then who decides that, and when, and who gets to have the power to make that decision. All these types of things are really they're really dampened. They're really there's just like a cloud. I don't know if I'm ever gonna feel like it's an interesting philosophical debate to talk about free speech in the way that I actually used to. And I know we've kind of touched on this, but like Aaron and I have disagreed in the past when we were in college a million years ago. I used to be a free speech absolutist because I thought that we were moving in a more progressive direction, and that we weren't going to have to worry about Nazis on the street or white supremacists unless we were like in like the ass back end of like some backwoods rural area, and the thing that could fix that is education. And so I thought that that would be something that we could really eradicate from society here. And it's been shocking to see the degree to which I'm wrong about that. I think that certain types of speech I probably need to be restricted because the marketplace of ideas, because people can't, I don't know. Should people be able to upvote this? Should people be able to, can people distinguish? What about when there's so much fake news, so much disinformation, and there's huge big money behind this disinformation, behind this propaganda? I mean, I don't think there's gotta be a way to combat propaganda and purposeful disinformation. And it's really, yeah, I used to think that this was like an intellectually stimulating conversation, and now it just feels very urgent and depressing. And that's how I feel about a lot of different things. I used to think the Supreme Court was really fascinating, and yeah, I now find it really hard to think about the Supreme Court because I can't see them. I see the Supreme Court and I immediately, my mind thinks like Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Thomas. It's like, I think about the stolen seats and the sexual assailants that are on the bench, and all of the damage that's being done and that will be done in my lifetime. So yeah, not fun. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the point of this like relatively depressing rant actually is, aside from just to maybe hope that other people connect with it too, and this kind of feeling of like weariness and loss, we can connect over this pain and confusion and frustration, and then ideally grow from it, move forward, and do the work to make this world, this country better, and the country that we know it can be. And that is on all of us. So I think, like, you know, I took this moment to be very mopey this episode without a co-host. I'm just like, womp, womp. But hey, I'm also kind of, yeah, there's a lot going on. And again, like, as with all the time, there's a lot going on. It's really hard to actually pick a good thing. So it's just, thanks for humoring me. And now for We See You. All right, I'm going to kick things off with ICE, weaponizing therapy. This was from a Slate article last week that children are required to talk to therapists, but their words are being used against them. And in some instances, their words are just being like severely mistranslated. But in other cases, the words are just being manipulated or misconstrued or taken way too seriously, especially considering the context, which is that children are required to talk to therapists, these children in custody. So in some instances, there are cases where children are moved from better living spaces into more secure ones that are like basically prisons, based on something that they said in one of their required sessions with a therapist. Everything that they say can be used by ICE. And in one instance, a child named Kevin said that he had, quote, a passing feeling that he would explode. And he said that to his therapist, and he was moved into from a nicer place where he was living to a more controlled prison. Both therapists in the case of this child have resigned. They didn't know, the lawyers didn't know that ICE was using therapy session notes in this way. It's an enormous betrayal of what little trust these kids might have started to build with one adult, like one qualified adult who's supposed to be there to help understand them, to help them, to like it. As someone who has really benefited from therapy, and I think everyone should be in therapy, the idea of like my therapist's notes being turned over to anyone is horrifying. It's such a betrayal. It would be such a betrayal. It's one of those like main tenets that you have confidentiality with your therapist, unless you are a harm to yourself or others. That is so crucial. So this is just so disturbing. And the defense of this policy is that, you know, we need to balance confidentiality with national security. If a child is going to be a danger to the community, we should be able to step in. With a heaping grain of salt. Like, who gets to decide? I mean, the therapist should be able to be the one who says, I'm going to flag this statement and perhaps pass it on. But I mean, I don't know if any like qualified therapist would really pass it on to ICE or the Office of Refugee Resettlement. I mean, that is outrageous, you know, but that should be between the therapist and the child. And then the therapist, who's certainly qualified, can decide with like what the proportion of severity is needed based on what the child says. It's just really horrible. In this case, with a child that's name is Kevin, the judge has specifically ordered him released. Like from this prison situation multiple times, and ICE continues to appeal it. They consider this case a high priority and say that he's a danger. And the judge keeps being like, he fucking isn't. But while this appeals process is going on, Kevin is still in jail. This is just awful. This is just my first We See You. I don't understand, once a judge rules that, you know, if this kid goes back to Honduras, he'll likely be killed. This is prison conditions are not where he should be. Based on the notes from the therapist, he's not a danger. You know, this kid is still stuck in this prison, despite the court order, with no actual release date. Like, all this uncertainty in his life and all this trauma, and for what exactly? ICE has really nothing to base the idea that he's a danger on anything, except for one therapist note where he said one time that he felt like exploding in a space that he considered safe. We see you. On to Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas. Yesterday, Trump tweeted, you know, that RBG and Justice Sonia Sotomayor should recuse themselves from all cases involving him, arguing that they were biased. The fact that a president tweeted that such an absurd thing would be unheard of in any other administration, but here, it's just Tuesday. But if Trump wants to drill down on that whole issue of judicial bias, I'm more than happy to. So let's just begin with a headline from literally yesterday morning reporting that Ginny Thomas, the wife of the most silent and accused sexual assault, the most silent justice and accused of sexual assault, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, has for the last 18 months made it her business to try to influence personnel appointments at the White House and in other major government posts like the Justice Department, the State Department, the Treasury Department, and Homeland Security. The reporting indicates that although Ginny's interference has had its ups and downs, she and the conservative activist group she funded, Groundswell, have found more favor with the president recently because he's becoming more and more paranoid about who he can trust, and because her husband just happens to be an important stalwart conservative who will be hearing some pretty interesting cases related to Trump himself and some of Trump's signature policies. So we, of course, don't hear Trump express any type of interest in having Thomas recuse himself from these cases, despite the fact that his wife has literally compiled lists of quote-unquote disloyal conservatives for Trump's review, and he's acted on her recommendations. Both Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh regularly speak at conservative events and fundraisers, and both of them owe their seats to the machinations of a terrible man, Mitch McConnell, and a broken system that allowed him to be very terrible. Kavanaugh definitely owes Trump a favor, or maybe 50, so he should definitely recuse himself. Kavanaugh, who, in addition to being credibly accused of sexual assault, also perjured himself, I drink beer, and mysteriously had nearly $200,000 in baseball ticket debt wiped away as he received his nomination in the wake of Kennedy's retirement. Kennedy's son, by the way, also has some weird ties to Trump and the Trump administration. It's a fucking tangled web. So if we're going to start talking about recusals, let's begin with the wildly inappropriate meddling of Clarence Thomas's wife and maybe work our way down from there. We see you. And lastly, the Republicans in Oregon are at it again. Less than a year ago, we did a We See You when Oregon's Senate Republicans grabbed their passports and literally fled the state to avoid voting on a climate change bill. They just did it again. They left the state in order to deny Democrats a quorum to vote on a climate change bill. Honestly, this is shameful and they should all be thrown out of office. There should be some legal mechanism aside from impeachment to throw state lawmakers out of their seats if they are straight up thwarting the democratic process by refusing to do their job at all. The state's constitution requires 2/3 of senators to be present before voting can take place. Democrats hold 18 of the chamber's 30 seats, meaning they need 2 Republicans to join them to reach a quorum. The Senate's Republican leader, Herman Birchiger Jr., said in a statement that Democrats refused to work with Republicans and had voted down all their proposed amendments, and they leave us no other option but to boycott and deny a quorum. So there's a very real conversation going on about whether Democrats should bother to go high when Republicans go low, whether they should bother being the adults in the room when it gets them nowhere and leaves them with nothing, you know? And I think the Oregon Republicans are really adding fuel to the fire of when they go low, we see how low we go lower. Fuck that. God, it's so childish. We see you. And then for a good thing, I really struggled. But today the House passed the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, so that's good. Although I'm sure it's just going to sit on Mitch McConnell's desk without a vote. I'm truly looking forward to whatever reason he and his turtle jowls use to justify suppressing it. It's an anti-lynching act. Don't lynch. The sky is blue. Fuck. But in this moment, there has been whispers that this could be one of the few bills to get bipartisan support. So that's pretty cool. And if that is true, that's a good thing. Oh my goodness. And so that does it for me and my solo act here. Thanks for listening. And thanks for all of your support and all the comments and the great feedback